be observed in a pubescent individual, and for this reason homosexuality in adolescence is not considered unusual. Nor is such uncertainty exceptional for a young man with Henry's psychological structure. He had already implied this in some of his earlier dreams. But repression, as well as sexual uncertainty, may have caused the confusion about the sex of the prostitute. The female figure that has both attracted and repelled the dreamer is transformed, first of all into a man, and then into a saint. The second transformation eliminates everything sexual from the image, and implies that the only means of escape from the reality of sex lies in the adoption of an ascetic and holy life, denying the flesh. Such dramatic reversals are common in dreams. Something turns into its opposite, as the prostitute becomes a saint, as if to demonstrate that by transmutation even extreme opposites can change into each other. Henry also saw something significant in the saint's coat. A coat is often a symbol of the protective cover or mask, which Jung called the persona, that an individual presents to the world. It has two purposes. First, to make a specific impression on other people. Second, to conceal the individual's inner self from their prying eyes. The persona that Henry's dream gives the saint tells us something about his attitude to his fiancée and her friend. The saint's coat has the color of the friend's jacket, which Henry had admired, but it also had the shape of his fiancée's coat. This may imply that Henry's unconscious wanted to confer the quality of saintliness on both women in order to protect himself against their womanly attractiveness. Also, the coat is red, which, as has been noted before, is traditionally the symbolic color of feeling and passion. It thus gives the saint figure a kind of eroticized spirituality, a quality that is frequently found in men who repress their own sexuality and try to rely solely on their spirit or reason. Such an escape from the world of the flesh, however, is unnatural in a young person. In the first half of life, we should learn to accept our sexuality. It is essential to the preservation and continuation of our species. The dream seems to be reminding Henry of just this point. When the saint leaves the cave and walks down the road, descending from the heights toward the valley, he enters a second cave with rough-hewn benches and chairs, which reminds one of the early Christians' places of worship and refuge from persecution. This cave seems to be a healing, holy place, a place of meditation and of the mystery of transformation from the earthly to the heavenly, from the carnal to the spiritual. Henry is not permitted to follow the saint, but is turned out of the cave with all those present, that is, with his unconscious entities. Seemingly, Henry and all the others who are not followers of the saint are being told that they must live in the outside world. The dream seems to say that Henry must first succeed in outer life before he will be able to immerse himself in a religious or spiritual sphere. The figure of the saint also seems to symbolize, in a relatively undifferentiated, anticipatory fashion, the self, but Henry is not yet mature enough to stay in the immediate vicinity of this figure. How the analysis developed. In spite of an initial skepticism and resistance, Henry began to take a lively interest in the inner happenings of his psyche. He was obviously impressed by his dreams. They seemed to compensate for his unconscious life in a meaningful way and to give him valuable insights into his ambivalence, his vacillation, and his preference for passivity. After a time, more positive dreams appeared that showed that Henry was already well on his way. 2 months after his analysis had begun, he reported this dream. In the harbor of a little place not far from my home, on the shore of a lake in the neighborhood, locomotives and freight cars are being raised from the bottom of the lake where they had been sunk in the last war. First, a large cylinder like a locomotive boiler is brought up, then an enormous rusty freight car. The whole picture presents a horrible yet romantic sight. The recovered pieces have to be transported away under the rails and cables of the nearby railway station. Then the bottom of the lake changes into a green meadow. Here we see what a remarkable inner advance Henry has made. Locomotives, probably symbols of energy and dynamism, have been sunk, that is, repressed into the unconscious, but are now being brought into the light of day. With them are freight cars, in which all kinds of valuable cargo, psychic qualities, can be transported. Now that these objects have again become available for Henry's conscious life, he can begin to realize how much active power could be at his disposal. The transformation of the dark lake bottom into a meadow underlines his potential for positive action. Sometimes, on Henry's lonely journey toward maturity, he also received help from his feminine side. In his 24th dream, he meets a humpbacked girl. "I am on the way to a school together with an unknown young lady of small and dainty appearance, but disfigured by a hump. Many other people also go into the schoolhouse. While the others disperse to different rooms for singing lessons, the girl and I sit at a little square table. She gives me a private singing lesson. I feel an impulse of pity for her, and therefore kiss her on the mouth. I am conscious, however, that by this act I am unfaithful to my fiancée, even though it may be excusable." Singing is one of the immediate expressions of feelings. But, as we have seen, Henry is afraid of his feelings. He knows them only in an idealized adolescent form. Nevertheless, in this dream he is taught singing, the expression of feelings, at a square table. The table, with its four equal sides, is a representation of the fourfoldness motif, usually a symbol of completeness. Thus, the relation between singing and the square table seems to indicate that Henry must integrate his feeling side before he can achieve psychic wholeness. In fact, the singing lesson does move his feelings, and he kisses the girl on her mouth. Thereby, he has, in a sense, espoused her, otherwise he would not feel unfaithful. He has learned to relate to the woman within. Another dream demonstrates the part that this little humpbacked girl had to play in Henry's inner development. "I am in an unknown boys' school. During the instruction period, I secretly force my way into the house. I don't know for what purpose. I hide in the room behind a little square closet. The door to the corridor is half open. I fear being detected. An adult goes by without seeing me. But a little humpbacked girl comes in and sees me at once. She pulls me out of my hiding place." Not only does the same girl appear in both dreams, but both appearances take place in a schoolhouse. In each instance, Henry must learn something to assist his development. Seemingly, he would like to satisfy his desire for knowledge while remaining unnoticed and passive. The figure of a deformed little girl appears in numerous fairy tales. In such tales, the ugliness of the hump usually conceals great beauty, which is revealed when the right man comes to free the girl from a magic spell, often by a kiss. The girl in Henry's dream may be a symbol of Henry's soul, which also has to be released from the spell that has made it ugly. When the humpbacked girl tries to awaken Henry's feelings by song, or pulls him out of his dark hiding place, forcing him to confront the light of day, she shows herself as a helpful guide. Henry can and must, in a sense, belong simultaneously to both his fiancée and the little humpbacked girl, to the first as a representative of the real outer woman, and to the second as the embodiment of the inner psychic anima. The Oracle Dream. People who rely totally on their rational thinking and dismiss or repress every manifestation of their psychic life often have an almost inexplicable inclination to superstition. They listen to oracles and prophecies and can be easily hoodwinked or influenced by magicians and conjurers. And because dreams compensate one's outer life, the emphasis such people put on their intellect is offset by dreams in which they meet the irrational and cannot escape it. Henry experienced this phenomenon in the course of his analysis in an impressive way. Four extraordinary dreams, based on such irrational themes, represented decisive milestones in his spiritual development. The first of these came about 10 weeks after the analysis began. As Henry reported the dream, "Alone on an adventurous journey through South America, I feel at last the desire to return home. In a foreign city situated on a mountain, I try to reach the railway station, which I instinctively suspect to be in the center of the town at its highest level. I fear I may be too late. Fortunately, however, a vaulted passage breaks through the row of houses on my right, built closely together, as in the architecture of the Middle Ages, forming an impenetrable wall behind which the station is probably to be found. The whole scene offers a very picturesque aspect. I see the sunny, painted facades of the houses, the dark archway in whose shadowy obscurity four ragged figures have settled down on the pavement. With a sigh of relief, I hurry toward the passage, when suddenly a stranger, a trapper type, appears ahead of me, evidently filled with the same desire to catch the train. At our approach, the four gatekeepers, who turn out to be Chinese, jump up to prevent our passage. In the ensuing fight, my left leg is injured by the long nails on the left foot of one of the Chinese. An oracle has to decide now whether the way could be opened to us or whether our lives must be forfeited. I am the first to be dealt with. While my companion is bound and led inside, the Chinese consult the oracle by using little ivory sticks. The judgment goes against me, but I am given another chance. I am fettered and led aside, just as my companion was, and he now takes my place. In his presence, the oracle has to decide my fate for the second time. On this occasion, it is in my favor. I am saved. One immediately notices the singularity and the exceptional meaning of the dream, its wealth of symbols, and its compactness. However, it seemed as if Henry's conscious mind wanted to ignore the dream. Because of his skepticism toward the products of his unconscious, it was important not to expose the dream to the danger of rationalization, but rather to let it act on him without interference. So I refrained at first from my interpretation. Instead, I offered only one suggestion. I advised him to read and then to consult, as did the Chinese figures in his dream, the famous Chinese oracle book, the I Ching. The I Ching, the so-called Book of Changes, is a very ancient book of wisdom. Its roots go back to mythical times, and it comes to us in its present form from 3000 B.C. According to Richard Wilhelm, who translated it into German and provided an admirable commentary, both of the main branches of Chinese philosophy, Taoism and Confucianism, have their common origin in the I Ching. The book is based on the hypothesis of the oneness of man and the surrounding cosmos, and of the complementary pairs of opposites, yang and yin, that is, the male and female principles. It consists of 64 signs, each represented by a drawing made up of 6 lines. In these signs are contained all the possible combinations of yang and yin. The straight lines are looked upon as male, the broken lines as female. Each sign describes changes in the human or cosmic situation, and each prescribes, in a pictorial language, the course of action to be followed at such times. The Chinese consulted this oracle by means that indicated which of the signs was relevant at a given moment. They did so by using 50 small sticks in a rather complicated way that yielded a given number. Incidentally, Henry said that he had once read, probably in Jung's commentary on The Secret of the Golden Flower, of a strange game sometimes used by the Chinese to find out about the future. Today, the more usual method of consulting the I Ching is to use 3 coins. Each throw of the 3 coins yields 1 line. Heads, which stands for a male line, count as 3. Tails, a broken female line, count as 2. The coins are thrown 6 times, and the numbers that are produced indicate the sign or hexagram, that is, the set of 6 lines, to be consulted. But what significance has such fortune-telling for our own time? Even those who accept the idea that the I Ching is a storehouse of wisdom will find it hard to believe that consultation of the oracle is anything more than an experiment in the occult. It is indeed difficult to grasp that more is involved, for the ordinary person today consciously dismisses all divining techniques as archaic nonsense. Yet they are not nonsense. As Dr. Jung has shown, they are based on what he calls the principle of synchronicity, or, more simply, meaningful coincidence. He has described this difficult new idea in his essay, Synchronicity, an A-causal connecting principle. It is based on the assumption of an inner, unconscious knowledge that links a physical event with a psychic condition, so that a certain event that appears accidental or coincidental can in fact be psychically meaningful, and its meaning is often symbolically indicated through dreams that coincide with the event. Several weeks after having studied the I Ching, Henry followed my suggestion, with considerable skepticism, and threw the coins. What he found in the book had a tremendous impact on him. Briefly, the oracle to which he referred bore several startling references to his dream and to his psychological condition generally. By a remarkable synchronistic coincidence, the sign that was indicated by the coin pattern was called Meng, or youthful folly. In this chapter, there are several parallels to the dream motifs in question. According to the text of the I Ching, the three upper lines of this hexagram symbolize a mountain and have the meaning of keeping still. They can also be interpreted as a gate. The three lower lines symbolize water, the abyss, and the moon. All these symbols have occurred in Henry's previous dreams. Among many other statements that seemed to apply to Henry was the following warning. For youthful folly, it is the most hopeless thing to entangle itself in empty imaginings. The more obstinately it clings to such unreal fantasies, the more certainly will humiliation overtake it. Note, the symbolism in the three upper lines of the sign Meng, the gate, is mentioned in the I Ching, Volume 2, page 299, which also states that this sign is a bypath. It means little stones, doors and openings, eunuchs and watchmen, the fingers. For the sign Meng, see also Volume 1, page 20 and following. End of note. In this and other complex ways, the oracle seemed to be directly relevant to Henry's problem. This shook him. At first, he tried to suppress its effect by willpower, but he could not escape it or his dreams. The message of the I Ching seemed to touch him deeply in spite of the puzzling language in which it was expressed. He became overpowered by the very irrationality whose existence he had so long denied. Sometimes silent, sometimes irritated, reading the words that seemed to coincide so strongly with the symbols in his dreams, he said, "I must think all this over thoroughly," and he left before our session was up. He canceled his next session by telephone because of influenza and did not reappear. I waited, keeping still, because I supposed that he might not yet have digested the oracle. A month went by. Finally, Henry reappeared, excited and disconcerted, and told me what had happened in the meantime. Initially, his intellect, which he had until then relied upon so much, had suffered a great shock, and one that he had at first tried to suppress. However, he soon had to admit that the communications of the oracle were pursuing him. He had intended to consult the book again because